The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
Welcome to the FT's U.S. Election Countdown podcast. I'm Amy Keene in New York, and joining me from Washington, D.C., the last remaining region to caucus in this primary season, is Courtney Weaver. So there's no way around it. It's been a historic week. Hillary Clinton became the first female presidential candidate for either main party. And Courtney, I think regardless of your political affiliation, most people would agree that this was a pretty momentous week.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people have very complicated feelings towards Hillary Clinton. A lot of people have very negative feelings towards Hillary Clinton. But I think few people would disagree that this really is a historic achievement. And I think you felt that on Tuesday night, you know, after all the hiccups of the campaign, you know, all the challenges she's faced over her personal email server, the Benghazi hearing, her qualities as a candidate. It really felt on Tuesday night that it was one of the rare moments of this campaign where you were actually able to take a step back and think, you know, this is something that's never happened before. You know, we've never had a woman as the presidential nominee for one of the two leading parties.
I was at the Brooklyn Navy Yards. We were in basically it was a greenhouse structure, absolutely crammed, full of supporters and press, of course. And when she walked out on the stage to, you know, to that song Brave by Sarah Bareilles, it was this, you could just sort of see, I don't know if you'd call it a contentment, but there was a definitely a happiness. You know, she was sort of relishing in that moment. She made history, and you could definitely feel the excitement in the crowd. The other thing that I thought was interesting is that this was about 8 years from the day that Mrs. Clinton conceded to Barack Obama. What did she do differently this time around?
I mean, I think that's also, I mean, just to take a step back for a second, that's also part of why this moment feels so historic. You know, there was a Saturday Night Live skit a few weeks ago, you know, where the character playing Hillary Clinton, you know, jokes, you know, to Bernie Sanders, let me tell you a secret. I really, really want the presidency. And obviously everyone laughs because it's so obvious that Hillary Clinton really, really wants the presidency. You know, and this isn't, she hasn't just been fighting tooth and nail for the past year. She's been fighting for this for basically 8 years, you know, or longer.
Yeah, who knows,
if you
maybe longer.
Career in the Senate. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, so what did she do right this time? So she's, I mean, it's kind of a good metaphor, I feel like, for Hillary Clinton as a candidate. You know, as she has said herself, she's not a natural politician in terms of, you know, she's not this great orator like her husband is or Barack Obama is. She's not as maybe as charismatic as some other more prominent politicians. But she's incredibly, incredibly dogged and very thick-skinned and very resilient. And so I think what she did right this time is in 2008, her campaign was dogged by all these, by all this infighting between various campaign strategists. One of her chief campaign strategists quit in the spring of 2008, which contributed to this whole perception that, you know, her campaign didn't know what it was doing, that the candidate was mismanaged, that they couldn't come up with a clear message, and that they were really blindsided by Barack Obama and didn't really know how to handle him as a competitor. So this time, I think what's really interesting is if you think back to earlier this year, you know, she had some tough points in Iowa and New Hampshire, and there were some rumors at the time that Robbie Mook, her campaign manager, might have been about to get fired. He did not. He has remained with the campaign to this day. And they really just, they stuck with the plan. You know, you can criticize the plan. You can say, you know, she didn't have a very distinctive message. But at least there was no visible infighting. No one was reshuffled. No one lost their job. And even when it seemed, you know, in April when she was losing all these caucuses and primaries to Bernie Sanders, they kept, you know, they persisted and they didn't try to make her into something she was not or to change message.
Yeah, I spoke to several Clinton supporters on Tuesday night in Brooklyn, I mean, across different ages, different backgrounds, and I had a few questions for them. But the first was, why Hillary and why now? It's you know, sort of generally one of those, it's the first question you tend to ask. But the common thread throughout these conversations I had, it was a combination of, I've been a Hillary fan since her first lady days. I, you know, a few people said that. And the other significant point was something along the lines of, we need to show the rest of the world that Americans can be reasonable people. These are words from the supporters. And I think it really contrasts the way that these particular voters, these Clinton supporters, see what a Republican rival Donald Trump could do in terms of representing the country if he were to become president. So it was an overwhelming chorus of, you know, Hillary is the right woman and person for the job. Here's a bit of what they had to say.
I love that lady. I love her to death. So I'm a Democrat and I just want to be part of history.
I think it's so inspiring on so many levels, not because she's a woman, but she's an immensely smart person who has worked at being a leader.
I think this is a big moment of history to say who we are as Americans and how we're going to live and live within the rest of the world and gather people together and not be mean and not be spiteful and not be nasty. It's not necessary.
So I think the one sort of, I don't know if you call it an elephant in the room, it's pretty obvious. A few hours after Clinton had her moment in California, in Santa Monica, Senator Bernie Sanders had a very interesting speech. I think a lot of people were thinking that perhaps beforehand, perhaps it was going to be a concession speech. There was talk that he had spoken on the phone with both President Obama and Hillary Clinton. So what was Bernie Sanders doing in that speech? What did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that people walked away with two impressions. There are some people who seized on his comments, you know, the struggle is not over, we're going to fight until the convention. But I think I fall into the other camp where if you really parse what he's saying, when he's talking about the struggle, when he's talking about fighting to the convention, the sense I got was that he was talking more about ideas. You know, his campaign, he's always said his campaign is not just about him as a candidate. Mm-hmm. And when people in the crowd were chanting Bernie, you know, he was saying it's not just about Bernie, it's about all of us. So things that he's been fighting for, like increasing the federal minimum wage, reducing income inequality in America. To me, he was making the point that, you know, this campaign is not just about putting Bernie at the top of the Democratic presidential ticket. It's about, you know, really enacting change in the country and, you know, being a movement. So I think the question is, I think everyone is under the assumption, as much as, you know, Bernie and his campaign advisors have hinted at various points on the trail that he'll bring the fight literally to the convention floor in Philadelphia in July. I think the question now is in what manner he chooses to concede the race to Hillary Clinton and when.
You know, if you look at, there's been so much talk about the Republican establishment, but I think all eyes are on the Democratic establishment right now to say how, you know, for lack of a better phrase, how will they rein Bernie Sanders in? I think
there are two things to point out too. I mean, running for president and having the kind of success that Bernie Sanders has had, you know, winning all these caucuses and primaries, it's hard to walk away from that, especially when you've been attracting crowds of tens of thousands of people. You know, his crowds have been among the biggest that we've seen over the primary, you know, even bigger than Donald Trump sometimes.
The
other thing, I mean, there's so many of his supporters who they call themselves, you know, Bernie or bust supporters, where, you know, some of them mm-hmm. would rather see Donald Trump in the White House than Hillary Clinton. They hate Hillary Clinton. And there were a lot of those people, and mm-hmm. they'd waited 5 hours to hear him speak. And when he mentioned that he'd had this call with Hillary Clinton, they started booing. He has his own considerations to think about, but he also has to think about right. his supporters as well.
So putting the Democratic race aside for a second, it's starting to feel a little bit more symbolic than anything. There's another competitor that at least the Democratic Party has to consider, and that's one Mr. Donald Trump. He's had quite a week.
Yeah, I think you could argue that this has been the worst week he's had on the entire campaign, which is saying a lot because he's had obviously a lot of complicated weeks. So basically,
complicated is yes, definitely one way to put it.
Exactly. So everything started last week. So there's this case about Trump University, which is a now defunct educational program that Trump ran and that we have written about extensively in the paper. But mm-hmm. basically, all you need to know is that there is a judge who's overseeing a suit against Trump University. And last week, Trump suggested that the judge was a biased arbiter in the case because he is of Hispanic American heritage. In fact, the judge was born here in the U.S., in Indiana, but Trump suggested that he couldn't do his job correctly. And then a few days later, instead of, you know, retracting the remarks, he basically doubled down on them and said he didn't believe a Muslim judge would be a fair arbiter in a case against him either. And so what you've seen is this really, it's really interesting split in the Republican Party, or maybe not even a split, but basically Over the past couple of weeks, it seemed like all these Republican leaders were coming on board and endorsing Trump, including Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House. And then you had Ryan this week saying, whoa, 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 this is, you know, textbook racism is what he said. And so now you have these Republican leaders in a predicament. You know, this is not the first time that Trump has been called off for making allegedly racist accusations. You know, he initially refused to disavow the white supremacist David Duke when he endorsed him earlier in the campaign. You know, he had the comment about banning Muslims from entering the U.S., calling Mexicans rapists. But for some reason, this time it seems to have struck a chord. I mean, I think it drills down to the fact that Trump takes everything very personally, and his business is obviously very important to him. And I think it's kind of woken up some of these Republican leaders to thinking about what a U.S. judiciary would look like under President Trump. You know, is he going to use the tools at his disposal for his own business interests?
I mean, one of the things that struck me going back to some of the comments of Republican leaders, especially Paul Ryan, you know, you say those are, like you said, textbook racist comments, but I still support the candidate. How do you think that's going to play out among the larger Republican base as we head towards November? I mean, whether it's in congressional or Senate races, and then also in the general presidential race, it seems like a rather significant conflict.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. You basically have a divide in the Republican Party. You have some Republicans who are facing tough re-election fights for their seats, coming out now and saying, I cannot endorse Donald Trump because of these comments. And then you have other people like Ryan who are trying to hug this middle ground. And I don't know where it leaves. I mean, so Ryan is someone who's been long seen as this rising star in the Republican Party. But does this relationship to Trump and not being able to come on Trump decisively, will that taint him later on? It's hard to say.
Mm-hmm. I think that'll be an interesting sort of thing to watch. And his speech up in Westchester on Tuesday night, it took quite a different tone than we've become accustomed to.
So I think it's the third time he's used a teleprompter this entire campaign. And what that meant was that he stayed on message. You know, we've heard from Trump's campaign advisors that they always have trouble controlling him because his whole thing is he's a maverick. He always speaks off the cuff. No one knows what he's going to say, including the people who work for him. And this time he was obviously very scripted. But it was kind of a milquetoast speech, which was weird for Trump. You know, I think the one interesting takeaway of the speech was that some of the remarks he made about Clinton, and he really foreshadowed how he's going to go after her in the general election. So one thing he brought up was he brought up her time at the State Department. He alleged that she had been running the State Department like her own personal hedge fund, which is obviously an unsubstantiated claim, but an interesting tactic, especially when you think about how many voters don't trust Clinton, who think she's corrupt, who bought into Trump's attack line that, you know, she's crooked. And then the other thing he said, which I thought was interesting, was he said the Clintons have turned the politics of personal enrichment into an art form for themselves. And that I thought was particularly resonant just because it's something I've heard from a lot of voters on the trail. Most recently, I was in West Virginia and I was talking to a Democrat at a Bernie Sanders rally. And he was saying he couldn't vote for Clinton in November because he was sick of the Clintons. You know, he thought they were corrupt. And he said basically the same thing Trump said. He thought that they were all about their own personal enrichment. So it's just an interesting thing to leave us with, you know, as we head into next week. Here Clinton's in this historic moment. She seems to be on cloud nine. Bernie Sanders is fading into the background. All her qualms and the concerns we had about her as a candidate seem to be drifting away. And yet, just kind of a reminder how things can change quickly in this race. You know, 5 months to go until the election, and I'm sure there'll be weeks from now when Clinton will be on top and weeks when Trump will be on top. But it's definitely not over yet.
All right, that's it for this week. Thanks so much for listening. You can find us on Twitter. I'm at Amy P. Keane. That's AimePKeane. And Courtney's at Courtney_FT.
And you can also sign up for our daily campaign trail newsletter, White House Countdown, at ft.com/NBE. That stands for news by email. So again, that's ft.com/NBE. And be sure to download FT Politics wherever you get your podcasts, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Acast.
Thank you.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy. The latest episode of The Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of The Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.